by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Yama. I'm Bo Spearham, Camilla Ray Kuma and Mara Waring, and welcome to Let's Talk. I would like to acknowledge the country on which we are broadcasting from and to. I would also like to pay my respects to our old people and everybody who is tuning in from around the continent, listening via the National Indigenous Radio Service NOS or via our website 989fm.com.au. The 1st of December marks 60 years since the creation of the Morning Star flag, the national flag for the people of West Papua. And on the 1st of December and on the 1st of October 1962, the Indonesian government declared the whole of West Papua under their control. Most of West Papua, if not all, is occupied by the Indonesian military. And on the 1st of December, many West Papuans and their supporters from around the world fly the Morning Star flag in solidarity with the human rights abuses that continue to happen today. On the program, I speak with a First Nations man from here, Brother Nick Chesterfield, Brother Nick, and two West Papuan brothers, Ronnie and Atamatis. I start the program off. We start yarning. I start the show by asking them to tell us the name, the mob, and where they're from.
Oh, yes. Thank you, brother, for this time. My name is Amatus Do. I'm the chairman of the Diplomatic Council of Free Papua Movement, the DPNPBOPM, based in Brisbane. And I came from West Papua, and my area is Me, Deyai, Deyai Regency, according to Indonesian colonial administration. So it's near the, you know, Freeport, my ignorance area. Thank you.
My name's Nick Chesterfield. I'm with West Papua Media and journalist on West Papua issues.
And your mom?
And my mom, of course, Ghana and different Noongar and Kulin nations.
Deadly. Thanks, brother. And Ronnie?
Thank you, Brother Bo. It's a great honor to be speaking with you again. And I'm right now speaking to you from the Ngunnawal country, of the Ngunnawal people. And it's a great honor, basically. As we're speaking, I also come from West Papua, Yapen Island, and I'm a musician, activist, and all-round Free West Papua campaign. For the aspiration of the people of West Papua.
Ronnie, brother, could you tell us the importance of today? Why is the 1st of December a very significant date?
The 1st of December, certainly, as you already outlined, it is very significant for the people of West Papua when 60 years ago the Morning Star flag was first raised alongside the Netherlands flag with the national anthem. And prior to that, Australia's position for the roadmap for West Papua's achieving its independence 10 years down the track was basically culminated on that flag raising ceremony. And so it's significant. And the Morning Star flag itself symbolizes the spirit of unity, symbolizes hope, resilience, resistance, from the generations that have gone before us, and now the youths that are rising up and continue to aspire and hold on to this Morning Star flag. And many have died. Many have been in prison. Many not even born to see and wave this Morning Star flag. But for us, this year marks that 60 years, a big milestone. If we look at it within the self-determination and decolonization context within the Pacific, West Papua would be the first, one of the first nation state that gained full independence prior to Samoa. But with the proxy war that happens and the multinational interests and colonization, imperialism, capitalism has somewhat now makes many of us continue to aspire for that Morningstar flag to be flown and flying freely in our land.
Other than the 1st of December being one of the key main drivers for resistance, what are some of the other key drivers of the resistance struggle in West Papua, but then also abroad with West Papuans who now call various different places around the world home?
Well, the cultural resistance, the revival of culture, language, dance, the bloodlines, the song lines, it's essential. The identity of who we are and what we are, you know, fighting against neo-colonization that Indonesia is imposing and trying to wipe out and marginalize the voice of the people. And that is one thing that is continuing to be remaining relevant and exist and reclaiming that sovereignty of the indigenous people of West Papua. And I'm proud to see that it still continues. Living here now in Australia, the so-called Australia, Ngunnawal country, and to be able to connect through the land, some of the song lines as well, understanding that and how the dance, even the sound of the tifa in Papua, we call tifa, the drum, which has the guana skin. That sound does travel from the north even down to the south and to the Torres Strait Islands and across to the sea to other Melanesian countries and the kindred out in the region. And it's that sound that I can tell that, yes, where it has come from and where it is going towards. So that is also significant in continuing to maintaining that identity and resistance as well, and in celebrating today's the 60th anniversary as well of the Morningstar, but also commemorating that the ongoing struggle of the people that maintaining that cultural identity and right to self-determination.
What sort of repression and backlash does that have for West Papuans home, but then also maybe some of the political prisoners as well?
I'll just quickly, on that note of political prisoner with Brother Victor Yemo. Yes, he is a mass organizer, a leader, mobilizer, and we see that culminated in the anti-racism protest in 2019. And how the youth has and continues to inspire by his leadership. And this is something that we see the next generations of youth are coming out to really overlooking the factionalism, the in-between fights and the generations that goes before us. And Victor Yemo is a political prisoner, but many other political prisoners, the youths that are in prison, even in Sorong, some in Manokwari, and even in Merauke, and himself, Victor in Jayapura, they represent the new wave of leadership, the second degree of leadership that are coming through now, and really taking the movement, propelling the movement into the future. And so it also demonstrated there is hope that this issue of sovereignty and self-determination is alive, and it's reconnecting as well with like-minded young people, First Nation people here, and Brother Bo yourself. I remember when we did the part of the journey of the Freedom Flotilla that we came by, and we reconnect through that with Uncle Kevin Bazakot, and of course Brother Nick yourself with the arrival of the 43 West Papuan asylum seekers, including Brother Amatus. And so that is showing this new wave of leadership coming through in the self-determination struggle of the people, First Nation people, especially Indigenous people, where we connect through the struggles that we shared against colonization, against systemic racism and imperialism of this Western, dominant forces.
Just a follow-up question in regards to that as well. What is some of the abuse that West Papuans cop in regards to not just the 1st of December, but in general? I do know from conversations with West Papuan mob and other sort of, you know, allies to the West Papuan struggle that something even regarding the flag can be punishable as well. Could we talk a bit about that?
Exactly. I just want to briefly telling a little bit in a story why important West Papuans people celebrate this important day. As my brother Ronnie already speaking on behalf of us, but just I want to highlighting that the 1st of December is the first time ever recognized by the Netherlands, the former colony, for West Papuan's struggle for self-determination and independence. So as the former colony of the West Papuan territory. And before that, the old West Papuan's representation during the that, you know, time, that the government administrations, the representation coming from all West Papuans. And they posing the Netherlands governments that we have right to self-determination. And the government of Netherlands, they agreed to, you know, establish one of the political institutions, which is we call Nieuwgunia Raad. Nieuwgunia Raad is the first West Papuan National Council. That's the, you know, political representation or body of West Papuan people. From that, they designed the Morning Star flag and, you know, other West Papuan national, you know, symbols.
Mm-hmm.
It means that politically and legally, West Papua, ourselves call that West Papua is already state nations, because this is the Netherlands. This is the Netherlands, you know, recognition on the national symbol. Because the Netherlands recognize all United Nations, you know, charter and, you know, international law, that the Netherlands, they are their own colony, mm-hmm. the West Papua. When they understand about, you know, United Nations General Assembly resolution, which is the granting independence for colonized people and, you know, country, something like that. So today in every, you know, corner in West Papua, they are preparing that they are already, you know, gaining independence, but independence just, you know, came one. You know, one second. Like our, you know, supporter from Brisbane with me, with us here, friends, he just, you know, launching his music album. He said, freedom in 1971, just come one day and go on. It's a very, very, you know, emotional thought on everybody, you know, everybody heart, how, you know, they feel if they are, you know, their right for freedom is just someone to take away. That's the emotional day, basically, the 1st of December. And since that, you know, the Indonesian, you know, took over country with the military power, they call three commando.
If I could just jump in, yep. That one in itself should indicate, you know, why we should, you know, why there should be more attention, why we should be supporting, you know, groups such as this, or even media outlets like yourself, Nick, as well. Mm. I might just sort of get you to jump in, brother,
yeah,
and talk about West Papuan media and sort of your involvement in all of this.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, the role that we were playing was to bring frontline reports of what was actually going down on the ground, both from a civil resistance point of view on human rights issues and looking particularly at extractivism, you know, particularly the widespread colonisation of every part of West Papua that, you know, from the mining, the oil and gas, the all the fossil fuels and the illegal logging that's been happening, and as I've mentioned before, that all of these colonial extractivist projects have seen West Papuan defenders of the land as their enemy, as something to be wiped away so they can get rid of any kind of resistance, and just, you know, literally clear fell the land and pack it up and ship it to Bunnings. So it's, you know, every part of the situation that we try to report about, and that journalists obviously on the ground in West Papua have been trying to bring to the world, is, you know, intimately connected to the resistance to extractivism. I mean, there wouldn't have been an invasion if Western multinationals hadn't organised with the Indonesian military to take the largest, like, gold deposit on the planet.
Could you tell us a bit about some of the work that you're doing and some of the stories at the moment? I know you wanted to have a chat about the Highlands.
Yeah, so we're just kind of restarting our operations for West Papua Media after a several-year hiatus. But in doing so, we're going to be looking quite closely at, you know, getting real-time or fast, verifiable information out from the abuses that are happening all over the place.
So you get some journos, some West Papuan journos that are on the ground?
Partly. Partly it's utilising witness journalists, and people who are there on the ground, because journalists can't always get into a place. And, you know, West Papuan journalists, there's not a huge amount of West Papuan journalists. They're known. They're easily stopped by military blockades, by military operations areas. But there are a lot of technologically literate people up in the Highlands. There's a lot of priests, school teachers, just village heads, that sort of stuff. And, like, young generation students who've come back home from study who've, you know, everyone's got a mobile... you know, there's a lot of people with mobile phones. There's a lot of capacity to really to report what's happening on the ground. And if, you know, what we're trying to do is to create a standardised reporting system so that it's data-driven, and then, you know, international or outside journalists can then just use the source data and know that it's real, and just, you know, and then report on that.
Could you tell us a bit about, like, the repression that journalists would get? You know, you just mentioned if there's West Papuan journalists, they're easily identified, they're blocked, you know, from covering stories. There's even stories of, is it like Australian journalists back in the day sort of getting killed and stuff?
Yeah. So that's happened quite a bit. That was Mark Worth. He was allegedly, because it's still hard to prove, but he brought out an amazing documentary that he filmed in the lead up to 2000 and the Third Papuan People's Congress. Sorry, the Second Papuan People's Congress, which was, you know, the first big, massive independence meeting, and he was filming that. It was a bit of it was known as the Papuan Spring, and Mark Worth was a journalist who, because he was living in West Papua, he had West Papuan family, he died under very, very suspicious circumstances around the same time that the chief of the Presidium, Teus Eloway, was also assassinated by Kapasos. So there's... so obviously journalists aren't getting killed as often anymore due to really strong protective mechanisms that have happened, that have come about through the hard work of West Papuan journalists on the ground. However, in terms of... especially with the palm oil industry and illegal logging, there are places where journalists are often travelling by themselves, and they often get followed. Victor Mambor, who's the editor of Tabloid Juby, regularly has people putting him under threat, and he regularly has... I mean, recently someone tried to set fire to his car and, you know, smashed his car, so...
Oh, yeah. How, in regards to where West Papua is in Indonesia,
colonized by Indonesia.
Like in relation to, you know, is Indonesia connected to West Papua?
Geographically,
yeah. Well, or is there sort of like a, obviously like a...
Well, no, it's literally, yeah. It's a continent. It's part of our old continent here. Mm. Like, there's no geographic connection. It's linguistically, culturally, historically, and biologically as well. Like, the biome, bioregion is completely separate. Indonesia is Asia. This is Melanesia. I mean, there are Melanesian islands in the Indonesian Confederation, but...
And then my next question, sort of following up, like you just sort of mentioned, you know, when journalists, when activists, when, you know, just community mob over there, you know, it seems as if surveillance and the presence of Indonesian
intelligence
and military is everywhere.
Yeah, and it is. It's really all-encompassing. I mean... There's a lot of technologies that are used now, a lot of them supplied by Australia and other Western countries, to particularly for the mobile phone surveillance. So people still use mobile phones, but everyone's phone's tapped. There's a lot of fake, like, WhatsApp groups and stuff like that, which are started up, which are started by Indonesian military agents, and then... They get a lot of people on board with them. Mm. There's a resistance to that. There's a lot of more people using actual proper encrypted communications like Signal and other systems like that. There's still a reliance on WhatsApp and some of the compromised ones, but quite often... So there's also a concentration that happens. So quite regularly, the Indonesian military actually shuts off the internet when stuff's going down. Mm. So it completely shuts it down. You know, it's not as if they haven't got anything to hide, but they then concentrate all communications where they can. You know, if they make it difficult to communicate in one realm, then they kind of concentrate it into a certain place so that can capture all the traffic. You know, we use packet data surveillance systems, disruption systems. Israel, for instance, mm-hmm. provides tech that allows allows police agents to leave malware on people's phones. So it's the same thing all over the world. But it's particularly focused on journalists, human rights lawyers, and environmental activists, because they're the part of the greatest threats to, you know, the mafia extractivism gangs run by the military and the police.
You know, how involved are we?
We are entangled at an incredibly deep level with the genocide project in West Papua. The Indonesian military gets most of its international legitimacy from its relationships with Australian arms suppliers and the Australian military. We train the death squads. We train Detachment 88, the counter, quote-unquote, counter-terrorism group in... trained in at the Jakarta Centre for Law Enforcement Cooperation, which is run by the AFP. SAS trains Kopassus regularly, and they train them quite regularly in techniques like throwdown techniques, where they plant weapons on civilians. They train them in torture technique. Mm. Like, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, the ADF will always come and say that. But we teach them about humanitarian law and, you know, we teach them about how to respect human rights. And they teach them about what needs to be worked around because there's a really negative culture in the Australian Defence Force that, you know, it's hero worship of special forces, and that's the same in the Indonesian military. It's like, so it, you know, we're providing... helicopter-mounted grenade launching systems, which right now are being used to bomb That's Tales. Talus is the company that's supplying that, and that's being used right now to bomb lots of civilian areas and villages and set villages on fire right across the highlands in, I think it's 13... it's not just in Tanjai, it's in Oxabil, it's in Nduga. There's a lot of places. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, you were saying?
Oh, yeah, so thank you, Nick. You are, you know, following the... what happening in West Papua, basically with the armed conflict situation and human rights, you know, humanitarian crisis because of, you know, armed conflict. And, yeah, we have, you know, a couple of areas in West Papua, like Intanjaya, Ndungama, Punchakjaya, Maibrat, Oxibil, and Yahukimo. So that places is most West Papuan populated area. Most West Papuan populated area, and it is very remote area, and there is no any, you know, access by the their own Indonesian governments, you know, authorities, and also, you know, the media, and, you know, of course, international, you know, access. It's very, very hard. So that's,
Are most places in West Papua, you know, are they given Indonesian names? Or is most places still in West Papuan or Dutch? Or
generally they can still contain indigenous names. There's a few places like Jayapura, which is called that because it means victory city. I mean, it's like rubbing it in the conquest. And, you know,
I'd love to.
This is a very interesting question because the name always, you know, changing according to what Indonesians, you know, want. Like in the past, the West Papua before called Irian Jaya. Irian Jaya, it means that...
It's an acronym.
Acronyms of, you know, who those, you know, following anti-Netherlands.
Integrasi Republik Indonesia, anti-Netherland. The integration into the Republic of Indonesia while standing against Holland and Jaya, which means victory. It also stands for Integrasi Republik Indonesia Angkatan Nasional, which is integrate through the means of national war. Everywhere there is a colonial project and extractivism, they generally rename the area. Freeport, for instance, the Freeport mine, they called the city that was servicing it. They built a city halfway up the mountains called Tembagapura, and it's the same issue. Wherever they go, but generally, I mean, there's so many place names that it's just... they're not that creative.
I'd love to hear your story, brother, in terms of why you came to Australia and how you got here.
Thank you. I think, you know, some of Australians, they know about my journey because I came by boat in 2006, and that was the big news in Australia and also Indonesia. The key... You know, the main reason why I left my, you know, beautiful country and richest, you know, islands in terms of, you know, natural resources because of things when I was a little boy, like 8 years, and the Indonesian forces, they, you know, they took me in, you know, jail tonight. I was, you know, 8 years old boy, and Indonesia asked me, "Are you OPM member? TPN OPM. OPM is Organisasi Papua Merdeka Pre-Papua Movement and West Papua Liberation Army." So no, I said, "No, I don't know about the OPM." But they just, you know, took me. No, you are OPM. OPM member. So they put it me.
And you're 8 years old.
They're 8 years old.
Yeah.
So and. Yeah, I was born during the, you know, massive, you know, Indonesian military operations in 1979, 80s. So mentally is very, very, you know, destructive. I said I would love to be West Papuan man, but if I, you know, look, look at the my personality, it look very different. Not really, really West Papuans, because I was mixed. Mixed because the Indonesian indoctrination with their language, and you know, I was born under my mom, you know, under persecution situation. Yeah, because that's the first reason. And the second reason, when I was a university student in Manokwari, I led the peaceful demonstrations against Indonesian, you know, special autonomy law and the provincial, you know, separation. Like now we have West Papua province. Before they call Irian Jaya, Barat, West Irian in Manokwari. So I was one of the youth leader, student leader that organized all young people, educate them, understand them about our, you know, nationality. We are so really different with Indonesia. This is the like the another soft policy of Indonesia, because through the special autonomy law they can you know, give like the big funding, you know.
They can
pretend
that they're giving more actual autonomy, but it's generally, it generally becomes an issue where people
and
it's an excuse for more business interests from Indonesia to come and run their projects in West Papua and exclude Papuan people.
So it's basically the special autonomy law. It's just say that, oh, that entire, you know, aspect is running by, you know, West Papuans, native people. But for, you know, main area, which is like fiscal and monetary, is still, you know, controlled by Jakarta, the Venice military, and foreign affairs, and, you know, political affairs as well. So, and during the special autonomy, they given us that we can able to, you know, pretend or protect our identity, the cultural identity, you know, the political identity as well. And they recognize the Munistar flag was like a symbol of culture. But the fact that when you raise the Munistar flag, that means you go to, you know, 50 years jail.
For treason, Makar.
Yeah, treason, Makar. Even they, you know, accommodate this freedom of West Papuan to raise the Munistar flag under special autonomy law, but in the reality, when we, you know, raising Munistar flag, they say no. That's why they took me 2 weeks in the jail in Manokwari.
And my, anyway, or yeah, later on.
Yeah. Okay, that's why, and why I have to leave. And one special, you know, I think emotional, you know, the reason that one of the West Papuans, he was the Australian, former Australian soldier. He's West Papuan. He's West Papuan. So he told me when I was in a little boy, yeah, I was joined with the Australian, you know, defense force during the Second World War. Look at that. This is my, you know, card, ID card. So when you go to Australia, Australia will, you know, help you. That, you know, that's recent, yeah. That's why I came to Australia, and I learned about how Australia play key role in terms of, you know, Timor-Leste. Timor that Australia provide, you know, humanitarians and the security, UN peacekeeping mission, like that, because the situation is, very bad. That's why I came to Australia.
In this part of the conversation, I'd love to talk a bit about the resilience and the resistance of West Papuan people. Obviously, one of the big symbols is the flag, the Morningstar flag as well. As we know today, there will be rallies happening across Australia, across the world possibly, and over the next few days as well. Could you, for our listeners, let us know what's happening in Brisbane? And do you know anything happening around the country?
Oh, yes. Basically, across the in West Papua, it's already, you know, prepared in their own way. But what do you know that the, you know, international community don't know about you know, real situation is that there are two very challenging, you know, issue in West Papua. The first is that democracy is already dead. So any civilian movement like West Papua National Committee, they can't do and celebrate their own, you know, national day. And the second is because of, you know, because of the armed conflict, continuing armed conflict, and the big island of West Papua is already covering by Indonesian forces. So they don't have any, you know, opportunity to freely, you know, celebrate in the city. So mostly in the city they can celebrate with the, you know, prayer, you know, fasting. Mm. But of course, for the, you know, liberation fighters from you know, pre-Papua movements, they can raise in flag in the jungle across the, you know, regions. They have, you know, 34 regional command areas. So I just, you know, confirmed by them yesterday that they are ready. Mm-hmm. But yeah, their life is, you know, it's hard, but they are ready because they believe in their own land, they believe in their stone, they believe in their water and everything, in nature.
There are likely to be some very strong actions.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Here in Brisbane, what's the time that the rally is today?
Oh, yes, of course. We already advertised on the media that the 1st of December, about it started at 8:30 in the morning. But because of, you know, heavy rainy, they forecast here, heavy rainy, so probably... some people they can, you know, do, including me, and 8:30. But we move on to another couple of, you know, hours.
12 p.m. at King George Square.
12:30 at King George Square. Awesome. Yeah. And taking us out of the program, Brother Atamatis and friends will sing a West Papuan song. Brother, could you tell us a bit about the song?
That's the song, part of the independence, you know, inspiration song. In the independence inspiration song, and we have it more than that, but this one is very, you know, touch on our heart, that that's the hope for the West Papuans people, their way of life. So pretty much expressing about themselves, how to, you know, survive their life. Thank you.
Come on, cool.